The Judge Spotlight, Episode 14. Hello, you're listening to the Judge Spotlight podcast, and I'm your host, Tiani Lunga, and welcome to this 14th episode. I hope your summer is going well and that you're enjoying the sun wherever you are, or if you're in the South Hemisphere, then your winter is going well and hopefully it's not too cold. I'm having a very good summer and I'm really happy to be with you today and to keep you company for this next hour with another guest. In the last episodes, we have talked about how to build and grow an online audience on episode 12 with Steve Pelfreman, and last week with Jerry Goldstein, we talked about how to plan tours and how to book gigs. And today we're gonna continue to talk about many interesting things. And you know, we're gonna have something unique. We're gonna have a special behind the scene look at a jazz label and at a jazz club. Today's guest is Oliver Wandling, a British jazz promoter who's also the founder of the label called Babel Label, and he also works as artistic director of London's popular club, Vortex Jazz Club. Like always, I just quickly want to remind you that you can find all the past episodes of the Jazz Spotlight podcast at thejazzspotlight.com/podcast, and I would also like to invite you to join the Jazz Spotlight newsletter at thejazzspotlight.com/toolbox. This is episode 14, and remember that you can find the links of all the things we talk about with Oliver and in the show notes at thejazzspotlight.com/episode14. This is Oliver Wandling. Enjoy. Hey everybody, what's up? Yanni Lunga here, and welcome to this new episode of the Jazz Spotlight podcast. We continue our great series with our great guests, and I'm super excited about the one we have here today. Today we're gonna talk about many different things. We're gonna have a special behind the scenes look at a jazz record label and at a jazz venue. Our guest is a jazz promoter who in 2008 was nominated for a BBC Jazz Award for jazz services, and is the founder of the record label Babel Label, and is also the artistic director of London's based Vortex Jazz Club. It's with great pleasure that I welcome on the show Oliver Wandling. Hey Oliver, thank you so much for being on the show. How are you today?
I am fine today. I look forward and I'm intrigued to find out how things go.
All right, let's get started immediately, because You are a very, very, very busy man in jazz. You are involved in many projects. Let's start from the very beginning. How did you get started with jazz?
I got started mainly with jazz, obviously hearing it. I was more involved with classical music, but on the day or a few days after I arrived at university, someone offered me the opportunity to play in a band, which was more Dixieland than swing, but it was at Oxford University. There were a lot of balls and parties, and they said, hey, do you want to get involved? And I said, well, why not, if it means having a good time? So that really did open my ears over that time. And then that continued, and then I had another job totally. I was working at that time as an economist and in banking. Mm-hmm. But I was very lucky in the 80s. This band continued for a while, but I met a lot of the musicians who went on to form the band Loose Tubes, mm-hmm. that generation, and kept up with them. So then at the end of the 80s, when I had enough, really, of the financial world, I continued working with them. That led to the founding, actually, of Babel 20 years ago in 1994, because there weren't many labels around at the time which would release these artists' work. So I thought, okay, well, I'd better do it. There never have been many labels around, of course, to release a lot of these musicians, newer musicians' work, so there's no change there. And that's really how I started. So that's where, that was the main, then the next leap on at that time.
And as you mentioned, Babel Label, it's actually celebrating its 20th anniversary this year. So congratulations for.
Well, thank you very much. Yes. I don't know whether it's because I'm very clever or very stupid or very stubborn that has kept the label going for so long. I like to think that it's more likely the former than the latter. I'm a long-term optimist, and I remain a long-term optimist.
I actually love your quote. I was reading your interview with Downbeat magazine the other day, and I remember this that you just said, I'm a long-term optimist and a short-term pessimist. I like it. I think it's a very good, mindset to have.
The one thing that I particularly felt in moving out from the finance world and the city, and I was in doing options and involved with traders, was that actually they look very short term. And one thing that has always, and I've had great respect amongst musicians, is that they are committed for a lifetime. They work out what can they do to be playing music. And if you said to all musicians, what do you think you'll be doing when you're age 50, 60, 70, 80, I don't think any of them would say anything other than being a musician. How, they wouldn't be able to say, but certainly that is what they would be planning to be. And I think that commitment is fantastic. And indeed, as I've got to know, musicians of all those generations, indeed, I think that's been very much the case.
Yeah, I totally agree. And it's actually great to have so many artists who are committed, as you said. And you have been in business for about 30 years now, and with Babel Label for 20 years, but you were mentioning your Dixieland and band, like, time, so...
Yes, well, we had this band, and indeed in the 80s, that was when I had my other job, and I had all sorts of musicians who came and were appearing with that band, and I got to know them and obviously gave them work as they needed. All musicians need to work out how best to earn their living, and over time I got to hear more and more of their own music and their own recommendations, and that was almost... the way that I have learned most about the music, asking people whom they recommend, I eavesdrop on their conversations, and that's really how I've learned and broadened my knowledge as well.
And speaking of learning and music knowledge, now you have been as head of Babel Label for 20 years. How has jazz changed in these two decades? What do you think has changed?
I think musically, the freshness and whatever of even of albums 20 or 30 years ago hasn't changed. The way in which musicians are schooled and how they evolve to where they are has changed a hell of a lot over that time. 20 years ago, if you were talking to a musician, the first question was, who have you been playing with? Nowadays, it's where have you studied? Mm-hmm. And it's a real rarity. It's probably 10% or so of the musicians who haven't actually studied music in general, or jazz in particular, in some form or other. So that's one major change. The second one is, with obviously the advent of internet and so on, particularly the openness with which and the way musicians hook up with each other. I am often amazed who knows whom and what people know about. Of course, we've sort of lost, and to a great degree, this music was all about the live. It is still about the live performance. Mm-hmm. But you can certainly find so much now so easily with YouTube and things like that, and certainly looking at the history and awareness as well. So it's great to be able to find all those old footage and even footage, particularly I'm always amused with it's musicians whom I know or work with, and I look at what they were like 20 years ago. A lot of that is now increasingly up on the internet too, and that also changes just to say how, therefore, as a record label, you have to perceive what you are releasing. I think that's also different because you have to realize that there's an incredible history and a very strong history. And when you have a recording, it's not just the music of what's around you, but you have to say, what is it that makes it worth buying an album by one musician or another, as opposed to an album by Thelonious Monk or anyone like that, or Keith Jarrett or Louis Armstrong. And, you know, that's where records and recordings have to slot in as well. Mm-hmm. So that validity is a tough one, and is in many ways getting tougher, or certainly doesn't get easier.
And you were mentioning like the internet, how in a way he has made your job easier. Well, not only yours, but many jobs easier, because now we have access to, you mentioned, footages of many years ago, and one can get more easily in touch with other artists and so forth. But on the other hand, there are also some issues like illegal downloading and, you know, the shuttering of record shops and these kind of things. So how do you think the internet affect your work as head of a record label?
It's certainly very... there's been a change in terms of the distribution of albums. And yes, indeed, record shops have closed. I mean, now the main way that distributors sell their things and sell our albums is via Amazon, which has become very, very major. But what I find is that there is a greater openness internationally, like in the way that we talk to each other now. In the past, if you didn't have the distributor in the country, you wouldn't, no one would really know about your music at all. And I have to say, that's one of the nice things, that we're all part of the global nature of the fan base and the community, however small it may be, but at least it is much more global, and you feel less lonely as a result. In terms, and indeed, there's of course the discussion about whether how much less one might earn, and there's a lot of particular discussion about Spotify and about the impact of Spotify. I have to say, on the one side, yes, it is saddening that musicians earn less, but jazz has never been well treated in the music world. It's not that musicians in jazz were selling, or very few were selling, tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of albums that have now been caught by Spotify. I mean, the people who have raised that issue loudest are obviously those who have suffered more. And then you read about Tom York or David Byrne, they have suffered more. Jazz musicians, we're talking about what might have sold a few hundred copies worldwide. You know, they're now, at least they're now being heard worldwide, and the losses are not that great relatively. They're a little bit worse off, but then it does have another side, which is what we are noticing, that you have to go to be a bit of everything. I mean, we are ourselves looking much more at how can we help the musicians find the work that goes with being the record label as well. So the music gets heard as a recording, and one of the things about this music is, at the end of the day, a lot of it is about the live experience. And it still is, and it's still where things start from. And indeed, a lot of the greatest albums, as we know of this music, are often the live albums, even if the quality hasn't been quite so, the technical quality has lacked a bit. And I think that is... and so I think that we're helping out a lot more. Actually, another thing which also occurs to me, it's changed a lot, is the technical quality of recording. We've obviously moved from analog to digital, mainly. And it's now possible to get an incredibly high standard of recording in all sorts of locations. And indeed, we think more and more of the Vortex as a live recording studio, because you can, we have quite a few albums, and Babel has more and more albums that are recorded live, and the sound quality is fantastic, you know, which is also a very nice thing. So jazz has benefited from that, and this music has.
Yeah. And in terms of music promotion, on episode 4, we had Buddy Vogt, and we talked specifically about music distribution on SoundCloud. And, like, I think that SoundCloud, it's a different animal compared to Spotify, because with SoundCloud, artists make no revenue. And my question to you is, what do you think about such services like SoundCloud in the artist's perspective? When we think about promotion, is it a good tool, even though they don't make any money out of it? Or
it's a good add-on. I think that there are different technical qualities. I actually hope that Spotify, for example, never improves its sound quality much further than what it has done until now, because then people have that level. If they do want that extra quality of sound, they can get hold of the album. SoundCloud is good as an add-on because there are things. I mean, we have discussions, and musicians are saying, "Hey, I've got my album, but I've got these little extras, or I've got a track here or there. I've had a little bit of a nice gig. What can I do to just make that available too?" So it does add to the roundedness of the musician and of the availability of what one can get from them. And I mean, the more that you feel a personal contact and the completeness of the artist or label or whatever, then that's a lovely thing, and getting the mutual respect.
Yeah. And in terms of always music promotion advice, what advice would you have for musicians? What should they do to promote themselves and promote their music today with internet, social media, and all these great tools out there?
I think that it's you use them all, but you have to go back, and first of all, you have to start with good music. And even if you develop, and you can work very, very hard in getting your press kits together, I think that's all important as well. I think that you have to look at the videos, and you have to make that investment for a high quality of what you're disseminating. But I think that you mustn't get stupid about it, and people mustn't go completely. I think you must understand when to be cautious. But first and foremost, these musicians are musicians, and if you're not producing anything, if it's rubbish what you're producing, however much you may market it, as there's a phrase, you can't make a silk purse out of a sow's ear. You have to start with, don't forget that first and foremost, the quality of what you're doing, and then think, is it marketable? There's some great music which, of course, you know, will never get heard very far. And being realistic, you know, I mean, a lot of particularly the free improvising scene, they know that they never going to get large audiences. You have to, you know, just because you have a global market, don't think that you're going to earn money everywhere and anywhere. But if it's another way and helps you to do it, I said taking it carefully, not overdoing how you treat it, using. You've got to use your judgment, and you've got to remember, and you've got to respect the people out there as well. You know, the audience, you have to have a lot of respect for. They work, the audiences in this music, for this music, work very hard themselves. They can travel long distances to go to concerts. They work very hard to find what they are, what they do, and what they like to listen to as well. You know, so respect them. There's a mutual respect, and I think it does help that.
Yeah, I totally agree. And you talked about musical quality, that it's definitely the core, and, you know, that we should be the base for a musical career. And I bet that it's what you look for as a record label when you're looking for new artists to add to your roster. But does the way that they present and market themselves influence your decision whether to add some artist or not?
It'll have some effect, certainly. We're always looking at what the because you know, if you have, you want music to be heard. So I think that the music, I feel that if I'm releasing it, I want it to have something special about it. I mean, there is a lot of fine music out there. There's a lot of there are very few bad albums, but isn't it? You know, there's a lot of stuff you might get, they won't be very dynamic necessarily, or they're all right, and you will hear that all the time. But you want to say, what's going to make it worthwhile me listening to this particular musician and this particular album rather than another one? What makes it special? And I think that's a very vital side of the whole equation, really.
And what would you tell to up and coming artists who are looking for contracts with a record label?
Well, I think it's the way that I've moved more and more with my artists, it's a degree of partnership. The record labels still can do something to help the artist get heard and earn some money, which, you know, a musician in theory can do a lot on his own, but there are only 24 hours in a day. And at the end of the day, the more you spend on that time, I mean, you can, as you know, it's very easy to spend hours and hours trying to solve a conundrum. I've known that on Twitter or Facebook, or how to get something out there. And that time, at the end of the day, the musician should be a musician. So I think, you know, seeing that he's taking it seriously, seeing that the musician has a set of an approach which is very much a partnership, that you know it's not like which the major labels have done in the past. It's not like, okay, give me the money and I'll go away and make an album and then it's up to you to sell it and make me more money. Nowadays, as I said, it's very much a partnership that I work with the musicians, the way the albums get recorded, the way we talk about the albums, the way it gets. And I think if musicians, you need a mutual trust for each other. And I mean, if I feel, of course, I never know, you know, every time I work with an artist, I don't know whether I'm going to do one album with him or 15 albums with him. You can't make that decision. It's like any relationship. You assume that it's going to be something always happening there for the long term, but there are limits to how many albums I can release a year. I'm a small operation and I can't afford to get very much larger. And you have to have that. So there's a lot of trust. And, you know, it's you can almost decide whether you want to do an album by having a nice beer with that person or a cup of tea. I mean, it's like some of the best rehearsals are actually where musicians just sit around and have a cup of tea together to get to understand each other. And it's the same working with the record label. It's sitting down and having a very constructive conversation. And if you feel you can do that, then you're going to get somewhere. And if I feel, well, that music is something where I think has got a validity, has got, it's worth adding to the X 100,000 jazz albums that there are already there, that's fine as well. Of course, also, by the way, defining jazz in a very broad term, I have a very broad view of what it is about this music, more about, anyway.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, this success formula that you have had has been working, so the importance of the partnership, but put it at a very human level. So I like what you mentioned, for example, about musicians sitting around a cup of tea and talking, or even musicians with the label. I like it. And now you've been around 20 years, and what have been the biggest challenges for your label?
I think the challenge has been to constantly adapt, and record labels today are different to how they were 20 years ago. I mean, you know, what formats have been? We've been through so many formats over the last 20 years. You know, when I started 20 years ago, there were cassettes floating around, and we've been through mini discs, DATs, ADATs, SACD, God knows how many formats over the last 20 years. And it's being able to sort of float and be flexible, which is, I mean, one of the things that this music has always had about it. And I think to behave in that way has been very relevant to adapt to, you know, how the market is, how the number of shops are. While you, of course, get quite, and if you spend your whole life thinking, God, this is how it was, and you battle in that way, of course, how it was is important as well, but the past is a very important guide to the future. But just to behave as if the present and the future are just like the past doesn't work either. So those are the sort of challenges that really we're looking at to be current. And I must say that one of the things I do enjoy, while I didn't know when Babel started, was I just going to grow old disgracefully with the musicians with whom I started working with at the time? Like there were some of those loose tube musicians, Steve Arguelles or guitarist Billy Gaines and so on. I've been interested that the freshness has meant that I have worked a lot with quite new musicians, and I like being surrounded to keep that sort of spark by a number of the people who work with me, who are also relatively a lot younger. I mean, Paul Lewis, who's the my label manager, he's 29, and you know, much younger than, and they have a new perspective, and they can also help put stuff that I do in context and not let me get too set in my ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, definitely. I think it's very true what you said, that it's important in a way to have mixed or like many heads that think together and sometimes think differently and you know, provide more value to, in this case, to a record label. And in this, within these 20 years, if you were to choose one thing, what do you consider the biggest achievement of Babel label so far?
Survival. to survive and to keep going, and to continue to want to keep going, I think it's a great success. In the same way, I mean, if you look at how many record labels have bitten the dust over 20 years, and even that you realize that throwing money at the problem doesn't solve it, which is why we see so much less of the major labels than we used to. I mean, it's interesting that probably sitting in Europe, if we think of major labels nowadays, we're thinking of record labels like ECM or ACT, and they're major labels, but they're small. They're few, and they come from they've got the leadership of one or two, of an individual, each of those. And they are the majors of today. And we certainly don't, and if we're looking for exciting music, so, you know, if a new album arrives from Blue Note or Universal or whoever, we don't immediately say, gosh, it must be good because it's on a major label. We don't, but, you know, so that is, survival and continuing there is a big thing.
And if you were to give an advice to your colleague, to label owners, what would you tell them?
Stay committed to music, mm-hmm. first of all. And I have found, I mean, there have been a few albums I thought, oh, I'm going to do this album. Oh, it'll make me money. And the albums, if you think you're going to make money on an album and you do it for that criterion, it doesn't. You either will make some money in the near term, but you're disappointed by it, or you don't make money. It goes, it comes. So I think, first and foremost, look at ways of bringing out the right music, which then will, which you then will hope to make it sell. I had that conversation actually at the weekend with a musician who's not on Babel, and he said, if the concept's good, then the rest should look after itself. And that's probably it, at least. Even if an album hasn't sold nothing, at least it was worth being out there in the world, you know. So I think that is what's important.
Yeah, very, very, very good words. I like them. And now let's talk for a moment about Vortex Jazz Club. You mentioned it earlier that you said that sometimes you have some live sessions, and when you talked about the quality of sound and how it's improved today. So you are the artistic director of Vortex. Is it correct?
The vortex is run in a very fluid way. We have very few actual staff. As I would certainly call myself one of the most active directors of the vortex, in that I'm there a lot. It was founded 25 years ago by a man, David Mossman, who was a taxi driver, and he just got sucked into the music more by accident than design, and he's a very practical man, and he kept it going 15 years. It then was getting kicked out from where it started, and a few of us got together. I mean, I was there a lot because a lot of the musicians I worked with, it was one of their main outlets. So we said, oh, well, let's see if we can make it survive. First of all, we tried to buy the building, but that completely went wrong. But then by chance, we found a sympathetic landlord building a new building where we are today, where the vortex has now been for 10 years. And it's probably when we arrived in Dalston, that's probably something quite jazz-like. No one wanted to go to that area. And now, if you look at how London is perceived, it's now it's sort of like old. We seem like old men because it's actually the area of London which is probably one of the fastest growing in terms of creative energies and so on. And there, I mean, I like to compare it a little bit to perhaps like a Harlem in the 30s or Soho as it was in London after the Second World War, where so much was going on. So that's really it was going to try and see what was to try and make sure that there was still this good outlet to hear the music. And because the way in which I think the Vortex is the right kind of club, in that it's one where the audience trusts the musicians to deliver something good, and the musicians can go for it, and the audience listens most of the time to what the musicians are doing, and the musicians don't take that for granted. And I think that's the right sort of club, and that's what a jazz club ought to be. I mean, that a musician can try something out, can almost be, it's a bit like a seminar in a university, new research, and audiences are excited by that when they come to the Vortex. So it keeps the prices a bit lower. It's run very much. We have a lot of volunteers who are very passionate. There's a lot of passion and goodwill that keeps the Vortex alive, I have to say. Every night we have volunteers helping run the bar, running the door, running the sound, and it means that the musicians can relatively earn more. Some nights they earn very little, but at least they have a good night. They have a good experience, and it's a very nice thing when I meet a lot of the international musicians and a lot of the New York scene, and they say how much it means to them, and that's why we can get in for it. We fight above our weight. We have a standard at the Vortex which is way, way higher in a section of the club compared to the amounts of fee that we can pay the musicians. But if we say to them, well, you know, if you want to stay around, you want to hang around till 3 or 4 in the morning, that's fine. Very often, if the volunteers are really enjoying ourselves, there's an experience with them. But I think several times we've had musicians where they've left the Vortex and gone straight to the airport. that's for the Americans. So, and I think if we can do that, and we can set it up like that, then so much the better. And you do look at the number of the artists who enjoy and have enjoyed playing there, from the UK scene. The fact that it's been one of a privilege for me to get to know and be able to make jokes with a musician of the likes of Evan Parker, who plays every month at the Vortex, or in the UK, Kenny Wheeler, who lives down the road, or John Taylor, of that generation, Norma Winston. It's a privilege, and I've been really, you realize how much and what it's been, what it's done for them, and to keep that approach alive, and the freshness that all different generations of musicians regarded as a sort of home for them. They all get attached to it, and that's now the case still with the young The new generation is just coming out of college, or still in college, and we do the final examinations for the students from the Royal Academy of Music, and it's great fun. Mm-hmm. It's great. You know, we have right across the board. You know, we'll have on Monday we had the students from the Royal Academy of Music, and yesterday we had the band led by the great drummer Eddie Prevost, who did the band AMM. Going back to the 60s, and each of those loved being there, and they feel that, and even if they, you know, they will, and you know, Eddie Prevost has a big smile on his face. That's great, because they really don't earn, they don't earn as much as they deserve, but at least we can make up for it.
You know, Oliver, by hearing your words, it's just incredible what you're doing and what all of the Vortex staff are doing. And for me, what it's really incredible about Vortex is that not only is a very active jazz venues with shows pretty much every night, but also the fact that it's a non-for-profit organization. And what you mentioned, I think, is just incredible, that, you know, you and all the volunteers you have on a regular basis, and your colleagues and staffer, are really there, first of all, because you love jazz, and the fact that you say that many artists who have performed there have stayed until 5 o'clock and then just left straight to go to the airport, I think really, really speaks and resonates about the great work you are doing.
I mean, we don't, unlike some clubs, and I wish we did, we don't receive regular government grants. We receive some funds every year, mm-hmm. but we don't receive that many. But it means that we have to get in audiences to survive, which is good. The Vortex is doing... We're saying 300 to 350 concerts a year. We run through the summer. We'll be closed for a few days at the end of August. We close for a few days between Christmas and New Year. But the rest of the time, it's a concert every night. And I said, to keep that number of concerts going in a year on the shoestring paid staff that we have, well, you know, if they're going to work hard, then again, they've got to feel it's you've got to feel a positive frame of mind. Because if you did it based solely on the amount of money that you earn, like in a lot of jazz, and if you had that degree of you looked into the pure economic venture, you wouldn't bother. I mean, that's why the major labels have stopped doing a lot of jazz, and you know, running live music. It's a very difficult field to do. You'd earn more money than just running a bar. Mm-hmm. I mean, the overheads of having live music is quite substantial. You've got to have, you know, the PA, the sound, the light, the length of time, the number of charts, the amount of booze you can sell off the back of it is more limited, because people, obviously, you also want people to listen to the concerts. Mm-hmm. The Vortex is a listening venue. It's about if you want the music to be heard and respected, you've got to work out the ways of making that happen. You know, how that is that.
That's totally true. And how, obviously, now Vortex has been open for almost 30 years, so has a big audience of regulars and loyal fans, but how do you build an audience? What would you tell, for example, to owners of Jets Club who are just starting out? How can you build a loyal fan base?
Well, I think it's the same. You've got to make sure that you are that the music is put on correctly, properly. I think it's in a jazz club terms, which is not so big, that the musicians are not distant from their audience. It's one of the great things, and I mean the greatest bands have been, even when they played huge venues, you still felt sucked in to be one of them, to be almost part of the band, and that's what you have in a good. So you've got to set yourself up in that way in the club. You've got to be careful, because you can't afford to take losses. You know, and no one can take losses that much. I mean, I like to feel that, as they say, supply creates its own demand. You've got to really make it clear to what the audience is about. Make sure that they, and remind them every night to keep coming back. you've got to say, even if you don't, if the quality is there, I mean, it doesn't always work, but we'd have to say trust the venue. And if you have a, if you don't quite know what you want to do, even if you don't know the names of the musicians, just go along and check it out, you know. I mean, that is, you know, it was, when one looks at how Ronnie Scott started, and Ronnie Scott's has changed to a great degree today, it was clearly set up by a musician for musicians and lovers of the music. And that's what saw it through harder times. And I think that that is, I think that, that if one looks at it in those terms, that's really what you should think of what the club is there for. If you if the musicians come in and think they're just a means to an end for the owner, and they feel that they're not respected, they won't like it. And if you're not feeling respected, you've got to pay the musicians more, understandably. You know, you've got to balance everything out. So I think that's what I would say to look for, is just, you know, respect your musicians, respect your audiences, and then hope that it all, and keep your fingers crossed. hope that when you take the leap, you've got like a bungee jump. You've got something that prevents you actually falling in the water when you jump off the cliff.
And earlier you mentioned Evan Parker, that you said that he performs regularly at the venue once a month, so he has a residency. And you said that Vortex presents 300 and plus acts during the year, so you are very busy. And when it comes to putting together a lineup, a monthly lineup, how do you do that? How do you find, you know, where do you look for performers and guests?
It's I mean, we have to, again, it's you know, we have to have musicians that we have to look and see that we're going to get an audience. I mean, we have to, even if, you know, we get musicians, and a lot of European musicians will often get their travel paid, great. So you need a good quality. But I don't do the look always at the day to day, but the head of the, who's doing the day to day program, Lucy, she's getting 40 requests a day. So you've got to feel, how are you going to go beyond that? It's going to be a mixture. There's a limit to the number of concerts you can actually get to. So you're saying, if a musician wants to do it, it's got to be having a friend, having a connection, having something that makes you think, if we like it, the audience will like it. You don't, if you're doing 300 concerts, I have to say that I personally don't, I respect every concert that comes into the Vortex, and I respect, but I won't say that it's all what I would naturally want to go and hear myself every night, but to have a lot of respect for everybody who wants to come and play there and who gets their concert there. So I think you've got to feel that you've got that music that there's that side as well to it, that I respect it. And I said that comes in, that you feel that they understand what they're doing. And you're offering, and sometimes you can, we get musicians to set up little seasons. I mean, Evan Parker now does that every year for different countries. He just did one for France in January. And we had the great ICP Orchestra from Holland for a week last year. I mean, I think you have to be, it's friends, and finding a concert, it's having the, you know, friends are important. And finding a friend, I always say, when I'm increasingly talking now to musicians, say, how are we going to find a tour of the UK? And I say, you know, should we employ a PR? Should we be employing an agent? And I sometimes say, initially, just put the money aside, find a friend. I mean, that's what we've done. If we've had, we have some great musicians who are finding a lot of friends in other countries. The mm-hmm. young musicians. The old guard, if Evan Parker and that lot, they found each other in the 60s, you would find Han Benink or Alex von Schlippenbach in Berlin and so on, and they're friends. And there are new musicians finding friends together, and you know, that's how they are coming in, and they want to be, and they want to perform together. And I think so that's you know, if you feel that the person, you know, wants to do it, there's not, and okay, you want to pay them as much as you can, but if they say they're unhappy with the amount you pay, well, so be it. But you've got to realize that they've got to be realistic about what the venue is about as well. And it's great that we have seen a lot of groups that have got on to quite significant degrees of success in the UK. If you look at the band Polar Bear with Seb Rochford, that was in the I talked to David Mosford. He said he can remember when Mark Lockhart, the saxophonist who he knew well, said, "Hey, I've got the band, we've got this drummer, Seb Rochford. It's called Polar Bear. Can we come and do a gig?" You know, they've got to have something that also thinks it stands out, and that band stood out. Seb Rochford stood out because he has a lot of hair, and he stood out with two tenor saxophones. And you have, people. There is a guitarist whom I worked with a lot, a very crazy man, Billy Jenkins. He always had concepts. He would come in and do fashion seasons and football seasons, and you know, you have, and you think, yeah, you know, they got concept. They got the musicians who just want to stand up and play. That's if they can. They've got to do it better than anybody. But just to stand up and see the musicians and sort of do a very nice post Coltrane whatever. Well, you can get that in all sorts, and it's fine. But you want to feel that we're doing something a bit more than that for the audience and for the musicians. And if a musician just turns up and thinks it's a gig, he's going to be disappointed because he probably won't earn as much as he would have liked. Very rarely. So, you know, you've got to expect more.
Yeah, and I actually like that you mentioned the friendship kind side of it and the networking side of it, because on episode 7 we had saxophonist Ezra Brown who talked about touring the world, and he also emphasized the importance of making connections all over the world. And also Christoph de Gelt on episode 8, when we talked about music management and booking, he also spoke about the importance of building a network of, you know, of artists and labels and all these sort of things to build personal connections with your peers.
Very much, absolutely. It starts and you know, if you come in and think I'm going to spend money on getting a lot of PR, and you do your hit, and then it's like you want ripples. It's like you drop a stone in the pond, and you want the ripples. You don't want the stone to just drop in the thing and go plop, and that's it. And you want to, so you know, and you try and you look, and sometimes it works, and sometimes it doesn't. I mean, you know, and so you can't quite tell. But yeah, building networks, and they have the longest, they can last the longest for the musicians over the years, and even if you fall out for a while, you then get back together. I mean. That's what happened now with obviously that band, the band Loose Tubes. I was just listening to them. They weren't together. They were founded 30 years ago. They stopped 24 years ago, and a month ago they played again at Ronnie Scott's for the first time for 24 years. And a lot of them were always in contact with each other, but they sort of worked by the time when the night that I went in, and you wouldn't have thought that they hadn't played together for 24 years. And I think that was you know, it's not like blood is thicker than water, but it is, you know, you want to create those strong bonding. And I like, and jazz has not got ageism. Obviously, people make a lot of comment about the lack of women in jazz. But one thing that jazz, I must say, is fantastic over, the young and the old work together very happily. And it's almost like I think of it like mutual vampires. When you have when you see young musicians, we have with you have it with Evan Parker very often. He loves playing with. He was obviously the main mentor for a trumpeter like Peter Evans, and Peter Evans is very young. They love playing together, and you can see that they trade off each other. The youthful energy trades off the. Off the experience, and I see that a lot. There's a pianist I work with, Alexander Hawkins, and I've seen him when he does a duo with the drummer Louis Maholo, and they are having a whale of a time, and they're listening to each other. And I said, the old guy loves what a young guy is doing, stuff that's unexpected, and the young guy thinks this man's got the experience, and they're doing things. And I think that is those sorts of things are fantastic. And yes, having friends and the openness to work together and getting to know each other. I mean, I'm doing one or two things where things have evolved, and you know, it's musicians have met and they've got to know each other, and then I've got to know the musicians, and I'm doing other things with some of those musicians. I mean, a lot of that's the way that things go through. You often, I must say, as a record label and as a record label more than at the Vortex, it's been very rare that I've responded to just an album where I've just sent out the blue, where someone sends me his material. It's something which, you know, has to feel that has come up there. Vortex is different. I mean, with the number of concerts, you work in some other different ways. But it's very different to being a festival. If you've got a concert every night, you have a different approach to developing the music than if you're a festival. You know, you have 3 or 4 days and you have a very strong artistic lead. Anyway, I hope that should give you a bit of a help in answering that.
Yeah, no, and I also think that nowadays it's much easier to build relationships and networks, you know, because of Twitter and social media. And that's a way that you can kind of get into the radar of someone, let's say, of an artist. And then you start to get in touch. And with internet and YouTube, it's relatively easy to stay updated with what the other artist is doing, or, you know, a venue that you would be interesting in performing at is doing.
Yes, very much. I mean, it's been amazing how often I talk to a musician and how much they know about each other. They know a lot more about you talk to some of the young musicians in London, they probably know a lot more about what happens up your way than you might realize, and vice versa. It's really quite dramatic because this stuff is coming up the whole time. They're friends with each other on Facebook and so on and so forth, you know, and I do notice that how they do build relationships, and it can take time, but they've, you know, by the time they actually get to play together, they've had their cups of tea virtually over the internet, but they have done that, and you realize that that's how a lot of those connections have grown. You know, and then they're in contact with each other. Maybe by chance they meet at a festival, or actually it's one of the things I've learned about the Jazz Ahead event. One of the strongest things that happens is musicians have met each other there. It's not musicians who've got themselves gigs, but it's musicians meeting other musicians. Mm-hmm. And I've been quite surprised the number of times now when I speak to people about that. They've probably got more out of it in that regard than in terms of actually directly getting work. It's been creatively more stimulating.
That's very true. And Oliver, if people would like to learn more about you, where can they find you online?
Well, you can find, you go to the Babel website, babellabel.co.uk. It has the list of all that. It has obviously the list of our albums. We are about to improve our website very soon. These things take a lot longer nowadays than you always think. The website technology is one thinks is simplified, but it never gets easier. We're obviously on Facebook, on Twitter. I have little blogs that I do. Likewise, the Vortex. You can sign up on the Vortex. You can sign up to the mailing list, you can see the gigs. So that's usual ways, really. And of course, I'm always open if someone personally gets in touch with us, send through those things. That's great. I always love hearing from fans. It's one of those things that keeps on going, that there are actually people out there who like listening to the light and appreciate listening to the music. That's, you don't see that when people just, when you just get your return from your distributor every month, they just say, you bought, you know, I'd rather sell one album and the guy's passionate and contacts me than 10 albums. You just get a little bit of money in the post, you know. So that's how you can find out.
Mm-hmm. That's very true. Yeah, that is very true. Oliver, thank you so much for being on the show, for sharing your story, the story of Babel Label, and for telling us more about Vortex Jazz Club.
It's been my pleasure, and I know I've enjoyed coming up there a few times in the past, even when it's been quite cold. And I hope you have a good summer.
All right, you too. Thank you very much.
Okay, welcome back.
And that was Oliver Wendling. Oliver, if you're listening, thank you again for being on the show and for, you know, for telling us a little bit more about Babel Label and the Vortex Jazz Club, as well as, you know, other things that we talked about. So again, remember that, you know, we've talked about many things, and, you know, in case you were maybe taking notes, but you didn't manage to take notes all the way, remember that you can find everything at thejazzspotlight.com/episode14. And also, I have a quick or a small announcement to make that this weekend here in Finland is going to be the popular jazz festival, a summer jazz festival called Pori Jazz Festival, and I'm going to be there. So if you happen to be in Pori, make sure to give me a shout out on Twitter so that we can meet in person. If you go at Jazz Spotlight, that's the Twitter username, give me a shout out and I will be more than happy to meet you in person at Pori Jazz and to talk a little bit about, you know, what you're doing and what your interests are. Just really feel free. I will be more than happy to meet you there at Pori Jazz. I will be there already from Thursday until until Saturday evening. So make sure to give me a shout out. And also, if you're not planning to go to Pori Jazz, give me a shout out anyway. If you, you know, if you have been enjoying the podcast, if you have been enjoying the website, the festival and clubs listings, the blog, if you have benefit from the Jazz Spotlight newsletter, feel free to give me a shout out on social media. And, you know, I will be more than happy then to connect with you and talk about all the great things I'm sure that we can talk about together. I am Jani Lunga, and this is the Jazz Spotlight. Talk to you next week. Have a great day.